Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
The issue isn't finding the right policy. The issue is, what the heck are we doing with an economic system that crashes as often as this one does, that forces us into policies that are as dangerous as this money pumping that we've just done, and that then caps it all off by forcing us to reverse direction with the risk that that plunges us back down. This is an economic system that is unacceptable because it doesn't work very well, and we could do better.
That's our featured guest today, Dr. Richard Wolff, with whom we'll spend an extended visit talking about a survey of issues that have emerged of late on the global stage relating to capitalism's turbulent and insecure reign as a ruling economic system. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, back again with you to offer some perspective on recent economic developments and issues that underlie the news headlines that were all served by the national media. Rick Wolff, who is a renowned and singular national voice taking issue with the trappings of capitalism, is a leading national scholar on its mechanics, which rock entire nations the world over as it rolls over economies and democracies. Who's Afraid of Richard Wolff was the title of our last visit with Rick, because he is yet another observer who refuses to admire the emperor's new clothes. And he's great at revealing the embarrassing truths that accompany capitalism's reign of arrogant self-interest. Don't be afraid. Dr. Wolff will help you understand your chronic debt dependency. As you may know, Richard Wolff is a strong proponent of creating public banks as a practical antidote to the systemic deprivation of credit to people and governments. While many of us follow the headline stories that discombobulate the actual forces at play in the national and global economy, the more you hear about what's really going on, the clearer the picture becomes. If we want a real change in the prospects of our economy, we must craft it ourselves and away from the formulations and controls of the existing monetary regime. That's why the public banking movement is taking off around the country, because governmental leaders at all levels of government are recognizing that they're stuck in a downward whirlpool cycle of debt and taxes. In order to address the budgetary needs and to help assist local lending institutions in moving credit out to consumers. So on today's program, we're going to be taking a peripheral look at how capitalism has actually closed down some of the space for more egalitarian opportunities, while the general populace, us, must recurringly pay the price of its built-in preferences. And you'll get a good solid primer on the whole China economic phenomenon with Rick. If you've ever wondered how we got into this economic lockstep with them, stay tuned for an insightful lesson from this noted professor. Matt Stannard will be along also to take another insightful look at the impacts of capitalism on economic justice factors. And Ellen and I will be discussing a notion that the Federal Reserve should have had on its own, QE for the people. So let's get to it and join Ellen Brown.
It's my great honor and pleasure to be speaking with Richard Wolff. Professor Wolff taught economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst for 35 years and is currently a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. He is also currently in great demand as a public speaker. It's so great to talk to you, Richard.
Hi, Ellen. Glad to do it.
There's a lot in the news right now to discuss, but I wanted to start with China. You're known as an expert in Marxist and socialist, and I don't know what if you'd call it cooperative economics. So I just wonder what your take on was on the whole China situation. It's been blamed for the market roller coaster in the U.S. The Chinese market dropped substantially following a drop in its currency peg. And so you read all over the net that it's the start of currency wars and competitive devaluations and hyperinflation and so forth. But it doesn't seem to me that that's what's really going on. So anyway, I wondered what your take was.
Well, I think it's an enormous issue and a question. I agree with you in the sense that blaming the Chinese for the stock market troubles of the United States is a cheap shot and has no substance at all. The fact that the Cold War is over and that the Chinese economy has sharply changed seems to have escaped these rather big items in the news, seems to have escaped the mentality of all kinds of politicians and media folks who think there's still a dead horse that they can beat over here, and so they beat it, and bashing China is just... Mr. Trump does that, and he invents reasons along the way, so everybody else is piling on. Let's take a look at the Chinese economy, its strengths and weaknesses, and I think that will answer the question. Okay, first the strengths. The Chinese economy has grown as fast or faster than any other major economy in the world for 25 years, mostly a lot faster. This year, the Chinese are very chagrined that they may have to live with as little as a 7% rate of growth. That is more than three times the rate of growth of the United States. And so for the Chinese to be chagrined would mean that the United States would have to hang its head in abject shame by comparison. And it's not a flash in the pan. 7% is slower than the Chinese economy has grown over much of the last couple of decades. And that explains why, from having been one of the poorest countries in the world a generation ago, China is today the number two economy in the world. Whatever else one has to say about China, economic growth, and that includes rising real wages for its workers, have been outstanding performers in the world economy for quite a long time. And before you pick up the shovel to bash them some more, you might take a look at that reality and think about what it means. Second strength. Along the way, the Chinese developed their powerful economy by making it an export-based economy. In other words, what the Chinese did was to say, basically, that their own people were too poor, numerous as they are, were too poor to provide a market that would sustain the industrialization of China. That the only way China could become a modern industrial power was if it produced the factories and all the other paraphernalia needed to produce for the world economy, not just for the Chinese economy. And they did that. That's how they came to produce the clothing, then the appliances, and now, indeed, virtually everything that the rest of the world needs, both consumer goods and capital goods. And along the way, they accumulated a vast amount of money. The revenue from selling all those goods produced in China to the rest of the world. And above all, they sold to the United States, which is the richest consumer economy in the world, thereby accumulating lots of dollars. Well, what did they do with all the dollars they accumulated? Well, the answer is they lent them back to the United States, and particularly they lent them to the United States government. Meaning that here we are toward the end of 2015, and the following statement summarizes what's been going on for 20 years. The United States is the largest debtor economy in the world. That is, we owe more money than any other country. Nobody's even close. And number two, the number one creditor of the United States is the People's Republic of China. We, the U.S., are the debtor. They, the communist-led government of China, is the creditor for the debt-ridden United States. These are signs of economic strength, growth, and considerable success. How did the Chinese do it? Well, there's no nice way to say what I'm about to say, so I'll be blunt. They made a sharp turn in their economic policy toward capitalism. They, in fact, made their economy dependent upon capitalism in two major ways. First, by becoming an export-focused economy, they hitched their wagon, their economic well-being, to the success or not of the economies of Western Europe, North America, and Japan. That is, the center of the capitalist economic global system, which is in those three areas. The only way China could industrialize and the only way China could become a modern economic powerhouse was by being a dependent seller to the capitalist part of the world, par excellence, Western Europe, North America, and Japan. The second way China hitched its star to capitalism was by inviting huge private capitalist enterprises, manufacturers, service producers, banks, all kinds of our leading huge capitalist multinational corporations. They were invited to go into China to set up shop inside China, to hire Chinese workers, and to produce alongside the enterprises that China itself had built up, many of which were owned and operated by various levels of the Chinese government. In other words, Chinese industrialization became a mix of government enterprises owned and operated by the Chinese and private enterprises, the bulk of which were foreign, Japanese, German, American, Canadian, and so on. And so in that process, the quote-unquote socialist economy of China really took on major features, if you might say, certainly an enormous dependence on capitalism. And if you do that, if you become dependent upon, interwoven with capitalism, then you're going to become vulnerable to whatever the problems of capitalism happen to be. And two of them in particular merit conversation right now. One, capitalism is unstable. Every 4 to 7 years, for 300 years of capitalism's ascendancy in Europe and North America, they've had an economic downturn, a recession, or if it lasts long enough and cuts deep enough, a depression. Once China turned towards capitalism, it was only a matter of time before the Chinese capitalist economy would exhibit the same fluctuations, business cycles, sudden downturns, such as what we saw last month. This is much to do with capitalism and nothing particular to do with China. And likewise, if you invite big capitalist corporations in, then you are again going to vulnerabilize yourself to the second big quality of capitalism, which is to produce extreme wealth at one end of the spectrum and not to spread that wealth around very equally. And so China has become a much more unequal economic system ever since turning to capitalism, just like it has become vulnerable to cycles. I think that's what the meaning of the Chinese experience of the last few years represents more than anything else, and it now means that China is very largely integrated into and is a functioning part of world capitalism with no greater responsibility for what happens than applies to the United States or Europe or Japan.
That's interesting. It seems to me, though, that China is still largely socialist. Or, I mean, it's 80% of the banks are publicly owned, state-owned, and they actually issue credit that supports their industries, something that our capitalist system doesn't do.
Right.
Most of their big companies are state-owned. So arguably the reason they got so far ahead so quickly when they converted to some part of the capitalist model, that they kept that important part of the socialist, maybe I shouldn't use that term, colors it, but you know that one thing they kept was banks that were publicly owned.
Right.
And that
they kept
could
the
therefore
banks,
support
they kept
their
the banks
economy.
And they kept certain large industries. No, you're absolutely right. Their commitment is to having their industry and particularly their financial system much more tightly under government control than you have here in the West. In my own way of thinking, I think of this not so much as socialist, but as the government becoming itself a capitalist. For me, I prefer to think, and this is a question of your approach, it's not a question of right or wrong, but I prefer to think of the socialist alternative as really being based in things like worker cooperatives and ways for the average person to be much more directly involved in the decision-making of whatever enterprise he or she works at. I think what the Chinese mean by socialism, and you're quite right, Ellen, they do use that term, what they mean is when the government owns and operates something rather than the private sector, rather than worrying about how the government organizes the enterprises. And there you're quite right. They insist on having a huge government sector. And you're also right that they would point to their extraordinary record of economic growth for the last 20 years as the definitive evidence for what they consider to be the best kind of system to set up, with the government in that kind of position of making sure that growth happens, that resources are directed to what grows. It's a little bit awe-inspiring if you take a step back. Think of it this way. In Western Europe or in the United States or in Japan even, it took many, many decades, in fact, a century or two, to basically change these economies over from the agrarian, rural economic systems that they were to the modern, industrialized, urban-centered economy that they are now. The Chinese have made a transition that took other parts of the world centuries. They've basically done it in 25 years. It is mind-boggling. The world has never seen the transition of a population, and not all of the Chinese are involved, but of hundreds of millions of people becoming urban and industrial rather than rural and agricultural in an historically unbelievably short time. For me, as an economic historian, I'm actually amazed that there isn't vastly more turmoil and chaos in a society undergoing that kind of change in such a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, there are the ghost cities that is made much of here as showing the inefficiencies of their system. But I've read that those, too, aren't what they appear. I mean, they were part of this long-term planning where they're planning for the urbanization of the population, of them moving into the cities, so they have to have the cities there. I just wonder what your thought was on that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, are there inefficiencies? For sure. To imagine that you could make a transition of this historical magnitude without huge screw-ups, to use a technical term, is just naive. You can't possibly do that. No system has been invented that can do that, that I know of. Certainly the transitions that were accomplished in Western Europe, North America, and Japan were full of grotesque miscalculations of all kinds. Railroads built where there was no need, towns that later became ghost towns. Look at the city of Detroit for a modern example. In 1970, Detroit had 2 million people, was the place that presidents of the United States brought foreign visitors to show them how successful capitalism was. Here we are, 40 years later, and Detroit's population is 700,000, which means the majority of people were driven out of the city. Huge parts of Detroit are abandoned with vacant, burned-down houses. The unemployment rate there is catastrophic. The city financially is in bankruptcy. So the notion that you can screw up and make terribly bad decisions that disrupt millions of people's lives, that's a given with the way modern economies work. The Chinese do not appear to have done that anymore, and indeed look like they've done it a bit less than the rest of us did it. And to discover what they call these ghost cities, you're quite right. It's like many other things the Chinese have done, precisely because they have at least some planning. Not that the planning doesn't make mistakes, it does. But they have done some planning, and if you do planning, you don't only build after the population moves. You try to do that beforehand in terms both of housing and enterprises so that people have a relatively smooth transition from where they were to where their lives are now going to have to be focused. And the Chinese answer to the critique of the empty cities and factories has been precisely that. And, you know, my guess is the truth lies somewhere in between these things as planned and therefore perfectly reasonable and as unplanned and reflecting a certain amount of miscalculation or misperception or corruption and so on. But as I say, what we've said in the past about these transitions in Western Europe, North America, and Japan is that the final measure is not so much the chaos when it all happened, but did we end up with a higher standard of living for more people? I'm not sure that's the right way to measure it, but if we're going to measure our own history that way, it would seem a kind of strange move not to measure the Chinese history that way, and it's clear that they raised the standard of living of their people, that they achieved economic growth, and they did so to a greater extent in a shorter period of time than anybody else has so far been able to do.
One thing apparently they haven't done for their people is providing medical care as they used to do under the communist system. And so therefore, and also Social Security, and therefore people have moved into the stock market, but still only to a very minor degree. I think I read that only 6% of households are in the stock market.
And right. And for them, it is... They have a long history for reasons that I don't know enough about Chinese culture to be able to understand. But there is a strain within the Chinese culture of a very great interest in what we in the West would probably call gambling. So just like we here have people for whom Las Vegas and Atlantic City are endlessly attractive because of the gaming opportunities, the Chinese culture has something like that. And for them, the stock market has been an attractive, particularly in recent years, a place. But it is looked upon as a kind of official casino that you can play rather than an instrument of economic development. And when that happens, what you quickly see is that when there are sharp stock market drops, the people who go in naively and don't understand how markets work are so traumatized by seeing their investments disappear on them, sometimes overnight, that they quickly back away from the stock market, sort of like they touched a hot stove. Indeed, if you look at the statistics over the last 2 months, individual share owners here in the United States, and only 14% of our people in America own individual shares of stock. That is, only 14% play the stock market in any degree. But they have been leaving the stock market, cashing out in huge numbers in recent weeks, precisely because the volatility they just don't have the stomach for.
Yeah. Well, then turning to an economy that has a model that you approve, you've written about or talked about the German corporate model and right. the protections that this state provides for worker ownership or worker control?
Germany is a very interesting example because things are normal in Germany in the way of laws and traditions and way people interact that strike Americans when they hear about them as unimaginable. Let me give you two or three examples. First, every corporation in Germany that has 2,000 or more employees must give half the seats on its board of directors to those employees. In other words, the employees have their own representatives on the board of directors of the company. They don't have to own any shares in the company the way we do in this country. In the United States, the only way to get on a board of directors is to be elected by the shareholders. If the shareholders don't elect you, you're not on the board. Since shares are highly concentrated, roughly 1% of share owners own 3/4 of the shares, a tiny number of people in our society, a tiny minority, are actually the ones who select the boards of directors that run all of the major industries and major corporations in our society. Germany doesn't allow that. German workers in all companies of 2,000 or more workers, and that means all the large companies, they have worker representatives on the board of directors. It means that the workers know what the board is planning. It means that the workers have advanced information. If a corporation is thinking of moving production from Germany out of the country, if a major change of policy is to happen, worker representatives have some influence over them and sometimes the power to veto them and at least the knowledge much earlier about them, and that affects what you can do if the workers are going to know about it long before they do in other countries. It gives workers, therefore, a much more structural say over what happens in the economy than anything we have here in the United States. Number two, German workers long ago achieved and still have a much more developed social welfare program for working people. They have better pensions. They have a national health insurance system. They have the power through their social networks to secure the laws that make it mandatory to get 4 or more weeks of paid vacation from your employer every year as a matter of law, and so on and so on. Contracts are negotiated by labor unions for the country as a whole. The labor movement has not shrunken anything like the way it has in the United States in Germany. So you get across the board the power, the influence of working people through their representation on boards, through the laws, through the social welfare system that is secure, that is unlike what you have here in the United States. And in case anyone wonders about it, let's remind everyone that this has served the Germans very, very well. Their unemployment did not go up during the Great Recession since 2008. It has gone down in a straight line from then, or from 2008 and 9 to the present, and is the lowest in Europe right now, at about the range we are, without the massive exit from the labor force that we've had in this country. They are doing very well. Their economy is doing way better than ours. Their GDP has not shrunken and has grown faster than ours, and so on and so on and so on. So these measures that are good for their working class, that are supportive of the power and influence of their working class, have not, in fact, crippled or hamstrung them at all. In fact, if anything, seem to have worked in a way that has advantaged the German economy, even relative to those elsewhere in Europe. So I think that it's not that the Germans are not capitalist. They certainly are. Their industries are overwhelmingly private. They work for private profit and so on. Nor is it the case that they are not fighting against this worker power. The social welfare that the Germans have today is not as good as it was 10 and 20 years ago. So they are moving in the direction of weakening worker protections. But because they started further along on that road, and because the working class there is better organized with its own political parties, with its trade unions that have not been shrunken the way they have in this country, they've been able to protect their system for the working people much better than has been accomplished in the United States.
Yeah, and the reason that Germany particularly interests me is that they have a strong public banking system, the Sparkassen system, which actually is unlike the Chinese public banks, which are state-owned. In Germany, they are publicly owned at the local level. So they have a mandate to support their local businesses, and they're limited to their local community.
Yeah, it's so very interesting. Sparkasse in German really means the equivalent of English piggy bank. And it's understood that the Sparkasse, these institutions, which are owned and operated at local, regional levels by local, regional authorities, are fixtures of the German economy. That big private banks, which exist in Germany, do not attack them, do not undermine them, wouldn't dare. They're extremely popular. They're the way a great deal of local housing and commercial finance is organized. The accepted parts of the German economy and society, not at risk. It's as if we had in the United States, in our 50 states, something like what North Dakota has, only more so, and that it was part of our society, and anybody who attacked it would be thought of as a kook and someone whose attacks wouldn't be taken seriously.
Yeah, that's great. And you would think with a worker-supported model that maybe the workers would take all the profits and therefore the businesses wouldn't be so profitable, but you can just point to Germany and show that that's not true.
Not at all. It's often the case that when workers own and operate their own businesses, when workers are given major influence and power in corporate decisions, often the profitability goes up. I mean, it's just, and there's no great mystery to this, and it's something that you would think Americans would understand without any kind of problem. If the worker is an owner-operator and not just an employee coming to work and going home, then that worker has much more of a commitment to, a feeling for, a sense of pride and achievement in the success of his or her enterprise. If you want workers, look, let me do it a different way. An enormous amount of money is spent by American corporations every year, billions of dollars, in any kind of program that is designed to motivate, inspire the workers, to get them to feel more of a kinship with the well-being of the company as a whole, to get more invested in, psychologically in the company, to be more alert to the countless little ways they can improve the efficiency. Huge amounts of money get spent every year because the corporations recognize that there's a problem, that by organizing their workers to be 9-to-5 drones who are paid a salary but never listened to, only told what to do, etc., you don't get the best effort from your worker, so you need to spend billions to motivate and inspire. What those corporations don't want to face is the fact that year after year they have to spend it because those programs don't work. Because workers aren't stupid and they understand window dressing is different from the real McCoy. If you want the workers to feel that they have a vested interest in the enterprise, then give them a vested interest. Don't pretend. Don't give them a clever program designed to fool them into it. Give them the actual control, ownership, and commitment, if you like, to the enterprise. Make it real, and then you'll get from them what all your billions for psychological motivation have never achieved. Worker co-ops will get more out of the workers cooperating in the business they own and operate than you ever have gotten from them by treating them as people to be told what to do, to be given no say whatsoever, etc. And by the way, many German industrialists will tell you that even though they were against workers being on the board, it has in fact worked out for them very, very effectively. It's indeed, in Germany indeed, it's the workers who complain that even though they're on the boards, and even though that gets them some advantages, the dominant voice in the company still is the shareholder and the old industrialist. They have more power than they had, but they still have to share it, and they would argue they could do better if there was no such sharing, if the decisions were made only by the people who work in the enterprise, top to bottom, in a democratic way.
I think that's what we need in the public banking movement. If we just had a model, if we just had, besides the Bank of North Dakota, which people can say, well, it's been around for 100 years, and that's North Dakota, and they're agricultural, and they have oil, and, you know, you can think of all these reasons to distinguish that from your own state. But once you have a working model, and you can point to that and say, see, it worked beautifully there, then it seems to me everybody else will do it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look even at the history of American banking, that there were many banks, particularly in the middle of the country, but all around, that started as mutual banks, as banks that were put together by local people to get together, to band together, to pool their financial resources, and in order to help one another, that in many ways, the private banking system we know now is an aberration, is a way of distorting the whole initial idea of a bank that was often organized as a kind of mutual aid society among a group of farmers or small craftspeople and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's what we need to go back to, I think.
Exactly.
That sort of model.
Find a modern version that holds on to the cooperative mutual dimension while adjusting to the other conditions of a modern situation. But there's no reason to believe, and that's why the German Sparkasse is such a good example, there's no reason to believe that that old model of cooperation couldn't in fact be institutionalized now in a modern economy and give us both the flexibility of modern finance and the mutuality that banks began with. And for me, credit unions are another piece of evidence that that's doable.
Mm-hmm. I wondered if you would just comment briefly on this whole global quantitative easing phenomenon. I know the Chinese did something similar where the government stepped in to buy shares of stock to prop up their stock market. And we've got the Europeans and the Japanese and the U.S. So you have all the critics shouting that this is going to cause hyperinflation. But it seems to me that the money system actually needs to be supplemented. I mean, money is not getting in the pockets of consumers. And so what we really need is quantitative easing that does get into their pockets. And that what we have right now is not doing much good, but it's also not hyperinflating the system. So I just wondered what your comments were.
My comments run very similar to yours. Here's what I would add. The reason we have quantitative easing, and that is one bizarre term for what it ought to be called, which is massive injection of new money into the economic system. That is such a scary proposition on the face of it that I am personally convinced that such an arcane term as quantitative easing was invented because the other one is just too scary. So, but let's call it what it is. It happened after 2008 when the capitalist system globally crashed. There's no reason to be indirect about this. It crashed. We had a classic economic crash like the one in 1929, not as bad, at least not yet, but almost as bad. That's why it's called the, quote, Great Recession, which copies the term Great Depression from the 1930s. So anyway, one of the things that happened, and the most important for this conversation, right after 2008, was that the central banks, in the United States it's called the Federal Reserve, in Europe it's called the European Central Bank, or the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and so on, the central banks in the leading capitalist countries began to try to offset this terrible recession, to get people back to work, to get the economy going again, because, as usual, this capitalist system had, for no rational reason, suddenly stopped to working. People still wanted the jobs. They didn't have them. We still needed the output. It wasn't being produced. We had more than enough raw materials and machines for those people to keep working, but we couldn't figure out how to do it. That's how the capitalist system has always worked, and so it was collapsing around us. And to try to mitigate that problem, to try to end it, to try to make it less devastating, we pumped our economies full of money. And the money worked at least to the point that we slowed the hemorrhage, and while we still have millions of people out of work, we still have a lower median income today for an American family than we had in 2007. Nonetheless, we did prevent it from getting even worse. But the fear, and this is a reasonable fear, the fear was, oh my goodness, if you pump trillions more of money into the system, there is always the risk that that money will not just sit in some account, which is, by the way, what's happened, but will instead begin to be used to buy things, land, real estate, stocks and bonds, and then that would drive the prices of all those things up through the roof, because there's all of this extra money been pumped into the economy that's sitting around in bank accounts. And the fear that that could happen is what is now driving the Federal Reserve to consider raising interest rates, because that's what you do when you want to make sure that money doesn't chase after goods and drive up prices. But the fear of this crazy system we live in, the fear that the Federal Reserve has, is since our recovery has been very little of a recovery for the mass of people, only a recovery for the rich, the banks, and so on, the big banks, the fear is if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, it'll make it more expensive to buy a home, it'll make it more expensive to buy a car, and that will undermine this mediocre recovery for most people that we've had, and that's too dangerous. So you have the spectacle of an economy whose instability blows your mind, confronted by a government that doesn't know what to do and is almost more afraid of the results of what it did in the face of the downturn than it is afraid of the downturn itself. So it's bringing the money easing, the increase of money to an end, reversing the direction, but being very unsure, as it should be, whether they might not be making another terrible mistake. But of course, what no one is willing to ask is the obvious question. I often feel in this moment a little bit like that child with the story of the emperor's new clothes. The child who said, wait a minute, the emperor is not wearing new clothes. The emperor's naked. And I want to say, the problem here isn't coming up with the right policy, raise the interest rates now, do it in December, do it next year, oh no, do it last week. The issue isn't finding the right policy. The issue is, what the heck are we doing with an economic system that crashes as often as this one does, that forces us into policies that are as dangerous as this money pumping that we've just done, and that then caps it all off by forcing us to reverse direction with the risk that that plunges us back down. This is an economic system that is unacceptable because it doesn't work very well, and we could do better.
That's great. Thanks, Richard. Our time has come to an end, but do you want to give your website?
I'd love to, and I'd love to make sure that your listeners also know that in the near future, I'm very hopeful that on our radio program, Economic Update, we will be able to interview you and continue this conversation that way. The best place to go for what we do is very simple. It's called democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. And there you can see all the things we do and follow us, Facebook, Twitter, all of that.
Okay, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Take care.
My guest today has been Dr. Richard Wolff, noted economist, commentator, and theorist.
So, if the control of capital drives the health of an economy, how might we get more of it into the hands of the folks who are making the economy work and relying upon it, the people themselves? This is a hotly debated topic now among world economists and political leaders.
There's a new idea that's emerging in England with Jeremy Corbyn, who's running for the UK. What is going on in England, and what's the prospect for a people's QE? What does that mean?
Well, that's people's quantitative easing, which means a quantitative easing that would actually serve the people in some way. What he's proposing, Jeremy Corbyn is the leading UK Labour Party candidate for Prime Minister. So he has a shot at being Prime Minister. And what he's proposing is that the Bank of England has already done quantitative easing. It helps the banks. It helps the rich people. It seems to be pumping up the stock market, but it's not doing anything for the local economy. So this people's QE would create infrastructure. What he's proposing is that they invest in new large-scale housing, energy, and transport, which is something that, of course, we also need here. In fact, I'm currently writing a book called Infrastructure Without Debt that's on that very proposition.
So it's a very popular idea, but it has a lot of the old line financialists in a bit of a got their shorts in a wad, don't they?
They do. Well, of course, they say that this would be hyperinflationary. It's going to lead to Zimbabwe-style ruin, that if the country actually starts paying their bills with money created by the central bank, that it'll flood the economy with money and that'll drive prices up. But we've seen that that's not true. Quantitative easing has been going on, quantitative easing recently. You know, nobody's going into hyperinflation here. In fact, globally, economies are languishing. They're not growing like gangbusters, like their prices are not shooting up like you would expect. So why not? It's because the money actually hasn't gotten into the real economy. And the thing is, we need money in the real economy. So I'm just writing an article on this, that there's a flaw in the economic theory. The theory is that if you put money into the economy, it will have only one result, and that is it will drive up prices. But what they're not looking at is the converse of that. Like, too much money chasing too few goods drives prices up. But what about when you have too little money chasing too many goods, which is what we still have now, because consumers, the people who buy the goods, don't have the money to spend. They don't have jobs. They're using any money they do have to pay down their debt. So they're not out there shopping. And the rich people, they're not out there shopping either. I mean, they don't buy all those consumer goods that manufacturers make. They put their money into more money-making money things, into financial assets that are just acting like a parasite on the rest of the economy. So you've got to get some money into the pockets of the consumers.
So you're saying that basically we're short of money, that there's just not enough money in circulation, and that making more of it is what's necessary for the natural and really unstoppable growth of the economy. Growth meaning more people, more needs, ongoing demand for the ability to purchase and move the economy. So we need more money now, but the problem is what? If we make more money in the current system, we're creating more debt for ourselves, right?
Yeah, right. And so they won't do it. The governments are all opposed. They have debt. Our government, of course, has a debt ceiling. But the ECB has finally also done quantitative easing. So that's the other objection, is that there's an EU rule against it. Your governments are not allowed to borrow from their own central banks. But they're already doing it. The ECB is already buying government securities. So they've already broken the rule. So how about breaking the rule in a way that actually helps the economy? So anyway, my argument is that it's not your responsible way to avoid your debt. It's an absolutely necessary thing to get more money out there to get the economy moving again.
Well, I thought it was very interesting to see who has stood behind that idea. This is a Keynesian notion of pumping government funds into the economy. But Milton Friedman, Ben Bernanke, even the Council on Foreign Relations?
Right.
You would expect them to be against it. And yet Friedman was pretty outspoken about it and said, you know, we need to distribute this money. That's a big theoretical disconnect, it seems to me. Is that proving your point about the failing of the monetary theory?
Well, even Friedman has been misquoted. His quote about inflation is always everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon, there was a qualifier in there, something like other things being fixed. So you're assuming that you have a fixed supply, and therefore, just mathematically, of course, if you're going to throw more money at a limited supply, it's going to drive the prices up, just like property in London. There's nowhere to build in London. So when there's a hot property market, just more and more money drives the prices further and further up. But those other variables are not fixed. The other variables are the velocity of money, how rapidly it changes its hands, and the supply. And so as long as you have workers available and materials available to make more supply, throwing more money at it will create more supply, which is what we want. We want to be building roads and stuff. We want our workers out there working. But somebody's got to pay them. Who's going to pay them? It's got to be the government.
Thanks for this, Ellen, and see what happens next.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
There's a joke. In capitalism, humans exploit other humans. In communism, it's the other way around. I don't even believe that joke, and if you're listening to me, you probably don't believe it either, even though it's funny. It's a funny lie. I'm Matt Stannard, and this is the Public Banking Report, Telling Jokes. It's how I ease the tensions around me, in this case, theoretical tensions. You see, I'm a legal researcher, strategist, and writer for several groups devoted to economic justice. And within these groups are found ists of more varieties than the world's greatest pizza buffet. I do believe in public banking, and at the public banking conference in 2013 in San Rafael, California, there were Occupy folks, anarchists, socialists, libertarians, Tea Partiers, monetarists, Georgists, and Greens. And a lot of them were more than one thing inside. We had converged around public banking because all of those orientations favor a banking model offering transparency, democracy, local control, and saying goodbye to Wall Street. We've been arguing about economic models since we've had them, and there have been plenty of models that have tried in various ways to plan things that people felt shouldn't be left up to the market. And even before capitalism existed as such, there were class distinctions that begged to be overcome or ameliorated. And you even had benevolent socialist emperors and the like. And the concern has always been what the market does to the person, what happens in particularly when the market, by which we mean those in control of the market, impedes the health, development, or access of those who end up on the wrong side of it. Recent research confirmed that men and women were equally influential in hunter-gatherer civilizations. Other studies suggest that altruism is hardwired, perhaps an evolutionary aid, and in any case, very much a part of our intrinsic being, insofar as we have an intrinsic being. We don't completely know where inequality comes from, why it seems inevitable in market systems, why experiments in egalitarianism sometimes fail and reproduce inequality. There are a lot of theories floating around, but different worldviews tend to talk past each other. Where we come together with all of our various theories and differing ideological baggage, where we come together is in action, in getting things done that we can all agree on. That sounds simple, but I've seen it done successfully time and again in the nuclear freeze movement, in the minimum wage movement that we're slowly winning, against Keystone XL, where we've been performing impressively. And I've seen it done now in many places pushing for public banks. We're still fighting fierce battles against Wall Street, but I've seen rooms full of people with all kinds of beliefs and foundations come together in solidarity and love and pushing each other and themselves, awkwardly, ugly, beautiful, all of it. And it's hard to get things done. I don't know if I would have made the same choices as Syriza in Greece. Maybe I would have. Many of the choices those folks made were the best choices that they possibly could have made under those circumstances. It's hard to get things done. But getting things done is the point. That's why I'm willing to work with people I have theoretical differences with about markets and capitalism and banking, as long as we have the same values. We work for public banks because of capitalism's failure to function and maintain a stable economic footing. You can do that no matter how you feel about capitalism foundationally. But also, working for public banks, together with different people and with different views, working together at diversity will change your views about capitalism, just as it will change mine. There's an old Soviet joke. A worker wants to purchase a car. The car distributor says, "Okay, comrade, it'll be ready in 10 years. The worker says, "10 years? Okay, morning or afternoon, because I have a dentist appointment in the morning." There's an old capitalism joke. Workers in a factory approach the owner of the factory. They go into his office and ask, "Hey, where'd you get this factory?" The owner says, "Well, my father gave it to me." The workers say, "Oh, okay. Well, how did your father get it?" And the owner says, "Well, his father gave it to him. And before you ask, my grandfather got it from his father." So the workers say, "Oh, yeah? Well, how did he get it?" And the owner impatiently says, "He acquired capital and he fought for the land. He fought for it." And the workers say, "Well, okay, we'll fight you for it right now." Okay, you have to admit that was funny. Fight with me for public banks right now. It's our money, and that's not funny. Okay, I'm out.
That does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. If you'd like to stay current with Ellen's writing and commentary, visit ellenbrown.com. And if you'd like to know more about public banking and related developments around the country, please visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Visit them on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Public Banks Now. Our thanks to our guest today, and especially to our committed sponsors at Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to economic justice and fairness and the creation of new American public banks. Payment Management offers complimentary analysis of your current credit card needs and expenses at paymentmgmt.com. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money.